This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Social distancing guidelines have changed the way we go to the movies. But if indoor theaters are off the table, what about drive-ins? The pandemic has sparked new interest in outdoor movies, so we ask for your favorite drive-in memories. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys are here to talk about films featured in those memories, from sci-fi favorites to classic horror. Laura is the film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Divas series. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Laura, movie theaters closed in late March. I wonder how these theaters, well, let's take the Carolina Theater in Durham, for instance. How are they coping with this?
Well, of course, they are closed along with all of the other indoor theaters. And I've been reading a lot about reopening theaters, and half the articles say, well, now that people are so used to staying home and streaming films, movie going is essentially dead. And the other side of that is no one will ever want to sit on their couch again. And the minute that it's possible to go out and watch movies, people will want to. And the Carolina Fletcher Hall is in kind of a unique situation because they have 1,000 seats. So when the time does come to reopen, they can operate at, 25% of their capacity, and it still will be basically the biggest theater in the Triangle. So they are looking forward with some optimism to reopening again.
Marcia, obviously the film industry well-developed by now in the United States, but what about back in 1918 during that flu pandemic? Do we know how that affected movie theaters?
Well, yeah, I mean, it affected them similarly. And if you look at images from 1918, you see people wearing their masks and having the same concerns about proximity. And I think that's one of the interesting echoes of that flu pandemic to our current one, which is how are people going to go about life again? And Laura brought up the Carolina Theater and spacing. I mean, how do you enforce seat distancing? That's one of the most interesting challenges to think about going forward. And obviously you can have seat specific reservations, but there's some parties of one, some parties of two, some parties of 10. And then, Frank, you mentioned the film industry. The film industry, there's no production happening right now. So what are people going to play? Now, the Carolina is great because they do a lot of repertory, like what Laura programs there. But some films have been held waiting for the moment of reopening. But many others have been released on digital platforms. They've already had their kind of moment of premiere and first market run. So it's going to be a very interesting, challenging time. My heart goes out to theater owners right now. It is not going to be easy.
No, a lot.
The blockbusters are being held back. The films that are being released on home video platforms are ones that they would not have expected to have a huge box office for. So it's possible that those, high profile films would find a place at a theater like the Carolina just because they can open with probably tickets will all have to be in advance so they can plan ahead for how many people are going to be there so that there won't be lines at the box office, that there won't be people gathering in the lobby. They'll have to take all of these things into consideration.
Yeah, but I mean,
restrooms, concessions, all of these things are very complicated stories.
And as you said, go ahead, Marcia.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that the other complication here is that the states are all determining these different laws governing the reopening of theaters. And so it may be that you can open your blockbuster in 5 states, and it may be that the other ones aren't going to be open for another month or 2 months or 3 months. So I think this is a time of just complete rethinking of the way the film industry goes about its business of delivering its product to consumers.
Well,
which is exactly what happened after the pandemic in 1918. That's when the vertical integration of the studios buying theaters so that they would show only their product happened. And I've heard it rumored that the AMC theater chain, which is in financial difficulty, might actually be bought by Amazon and make an Amazon chain of theaters in which they can do a high-profile release of their films in theaters and then have it immediately go to their streaming service.
Wow. That would be interesting. So more consolidation could be an outcome of one of the many outcomes. Well, one of the things, I guess, one of the theaters that can do well is that old favorite, and I don't know how many of them are left, the drive-in. Marcia, what's the history of drive-ins in the U.S.?
Well, drive-ins, I think the first drive-in opened in the 1930s, but you mentioned the 1950s. That was certainly the heyday of the drive-in with the teenager and people piling into cars. I believe that there are like a little over 300 still going concerns in the United States, and there are three in North Carolina. There's one in Henderson, the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater, one in Kings Mountain, the Hounds Drive-In, and in Shelby, the Sunset Drive-In, that are still going. I was just on their websites, and even at the drive-ins, though, at the one in Shelby, they are doing 50% capacity and requiring masks for the bathroom and the snack bar. So it is not a free pass to, you know, do whatever you want. But man, it's a great alternative because you are in your unit and you have distance and you are outdoors.
Back in the day when there were no restrictions, a lot of our listeners remembered them as childhood memories.
This is Guy Bross from Raleigh. And my earliest movie memory happened in Chicago at the Skylark Drive-In. Now, I'm 6, my brother's 5, we're having dinner, and my dad says, get your pajamas on, we're sleeping in the car tonight. Got to realize how exciting that was for a 6-year-old. So my dad had their 61 four-door Impala with no seatbelts in the back, and he used to drive us to Florida every year for vacation, so he built this removable plywood deck to fit over the back seat, and he'd drive all night, and we'd get there in the morning. So anyways, we have our PJs on, we walk out to the car, and now we're really excited because the back's all set up with the plywood deck, pillows, blankets. We didn't know where we were going at that time, and then we ended up at the Skylark Drive-In. I remember being totally awestruck with the big white screen in front and the cast metal speaker in the window and my dad going out for snacks.
Add sweet cream butter to hot popcorn. Mix it up, wrap it up, Buttercup is born.
It's delicious.
So nutritious.
It's a taste delight.
So then the movie started, and they insisted that we go to sleep, which wasn't going to happen. We had pillows and blankets, but we were, like, totally jacked up. I remember trying to peek over the top of the seat, and I did remember seeing the shower scene. I remember seeing Mrs. Bates in the back, and my brother and I started this whole giggle fest about scary grandma. And then I fell asleep, and the next thing I remember was Dad was carrying us into the house.
That's Guy Bross telling us about going to see the 1960 Alfred Hitchcock film Psycho at the drive-in. And Laura, I guess that makes a pretty good drive-in movie, huh?
Well, I think it's so funny that this is a rookie mistake that parents make, thinking that they can take their kids someplace exciting and they'll just go to sleep.
Right.
Which clearly was not going to happen, because if they'd thought the kids were going to be awake, they probably would not have taken them to see Psycho.
Well, maybe they should have seen a mild family movie like Yours, Mine, and Ours.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I'm calling from Durham. And I wanted to share a favorite drive-in movie theater experience that I had when I was a young girl, which was that my family took all of the children in our family, all 7 of us, to see Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda in the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours, which is a story of their family. And I just remember sitting outside with all of us together. You know, we could see each other in the way that you can't in a regular movie theater. And for a young child, it was a really formative experience and such a happy movie that it was wonderful.
Good heavens, what did you do to this dress?
Oh, Mother, it was practically an antique. We just shortened it a little.
A little? I look like a teeny bopper.
What's wrong with that?
I can't go out in this.
Why not? Your legs are better than mine.
It'll be okay as soon as we shorten the slip. Give me those pins.
Oh, heavens. Jean, run downstairs and tell Tommy to whistle the minute he sees Mr. Beardsley.
But I want to walk.
Please, Jean, the minute he sees Mr. Beardsley.
Mother, will you stand still or are you going to get this pin stuck in you?
Oh, great. I'm put together with pins and glue. If there's a strong wind, I'm in trouble.
That's Chris Moorman talking about the 1968 film Yours, Mine, and Ours, starring Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda. Marsha, what was it about films, I guess, that, you know, Laura talked about the rookie mistake, but families, it was a family outing, right? I mean, it was a good place for families to go, I guess, right?
Absolutely. Well, Variety called this Socko Family Entertainment. In other words, the perfect movie for a family to go and see at a drive-in, where you could pile everyone in the car and it was cheap. And you could have a kind of warm family bonding experience over Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball and their blended families. But keep in mind, this is also 1968. And so I think probably families were looking for ways to have these experiences that were outside of what was happening in this country, which was a lot of protest and revolution and the counterculture coming into its forms. And so I think it's interesting to think about this as a bit of escape into a bit of a fantasy land that you could enjoy for a couple hours with your family. And what a contrast to Psycho and that shocking sex and violence, I mean, of the first caller.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The pandemic has altered our usual movie-going habits. We are going back to the age of the drive-in today. Flashy cars and parents with pajama-clad kids all had something in common. I'm talking with Marsha Gordon and Laura Boies about films that graced the drive-in screen, films that sometimes took a backseat to the experience. Marsha is a film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Laura is film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Divas series. And in the last segment, Marsha talked about Variety describing drive-ins as Socko entertainment for kids and families. Here's one that combines circus cinema and the drive-in.
My name is John Hearn from Wake Forest, North Carolina. My most memorable drive-in film was the very first one I saw as a six-year-old, which was The Greatest Show on Earth. It was about the Barnum and Bailey Circus, and I enjoyed seeing all the elephants and animals and all the acts and the train coming to town and unloading the cars and pulling up the big tent.
We bring you the circus. The Pied Piper, whose magic tunes lead children of all ages from 6 to 60 into a tinsel and spun candy world of reckless beauty and mounting laughter.
I was especially enamored by the trapeze artists played by Cornel Wilde and Betty Hutton. These aerial feats that I saw in film later inspired me as an elementary kid to try some things at school, such as spinning on a pull-up bar at school and climbing a grease pole at the 4th of July, where I won a watch. And I was frightened when Cornel Wilde fell off of the trapeze and hit the ground and almost died. And I was also frightened by the train wreck at the end. It was scary for a child.
Stop the train! Stop the train!
So for a six-year-old, this is a great and impressive movie.
That's John Hearn talking about The Greatest Show on Earth, which actually won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1953. He saw it at the drive-in, and Marsha, he said he tried to imitate some of the tricks he saw on the screen. Good thing he didn't see Psycho, is all I'm thinking.
It's true. Don't try this at home. But, I mean, what a deal. I mean, this is a film made for the drive-in in many ways, right? You get to go to a movie and go to the circus, all for the price of one car. And so, obviously, a very perfect family film. And a note on that Best Picture Oscar, many people were not happy because that was the year of High Noon, and people felt like this was, you know, pretty lowbrow entertainment compared to the seriousness of High Noon, but Cecil B. DeMille, it won.
And talk about circuses, Laura. The fact is that that drive-in theaters also had other features and other attractions going, petting zoos and all kinds of things, right?
That's right.
Not to mention what was going on in the car next to you.
Drive-in theaters have a lot of excitement, but somehow they're kind of tawdry in the same way, and that there's that tension, you know, between what you're seeing and kind of what is going on beneath.
Well, let's go back to the horror films, another memory about those.
My name is Steve Nelson. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. I grew up in Kinston, and the Brightleaf Drive-In Theater was off Highway 11. My parents took my sister and I in the summer times there. I was about 7 years old, and they decided to go see Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, Bette Davis, Pastor Prime. Early on in the film, there's a scene where a decapitated head rolls down the staircase, and I began screaming hysterically. And I remember my father being upset, my mom being upset, my sister being upset, and I just could not stop screaming at this film.
Will you stop that?
They'll be finding him soon, and they'll be asking questions, and I don't think I could lie to him. You'll have to tell him, ma'am. You'll have to tell him I'm not able to answer questions. They'll find out if you don't. They'll find out, ma'am. Find out.
And that memory, my parents loved to tell the story, but it was a source of much humor for them, not so much for me.
Steve Nelson talking about his memory of, apparently has it left him, that memory of Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte with Bette Davis. Hey, Laura, tell us about this film, though. Kind of an extraordinary film. Bette Davis at the end of her career, right?
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane started this whole cycle of horror films with these aging stars from the, you know, golden age of Hollywood. And they had to become more and more extreme. I mean, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is, it's a pretty good movie, you know, but then pretty soon it's sort of devolved to Ray Milland in Frogs, which is a movie I remember seeing in the 1960s.
What about the Marsha, what about this film itself? Yeah, the Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Yeah, well, yeah, so this is also Robert Aldrich by the same, you know, the same director who did Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And I have mixed feelings about these films because, you know, they are such a, there's such a step down for these amazing actresses of the golden age, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, Agnes Moorehead. And, you know, they're campy. And I have mixed feelings about these actresses obviously having a chance to work at a time in their careers and at a time in history where women, you know, frankly, over the age of 45, were not getting cast in leading roles. So at least they got to perform. But they're pretty humiliating roles at the end of the day. And we're not
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's another one of those what and leave show business kind of moments. You know, what will you do to keep working and stay on screen?
We you talked about campy too. And there, and this brings to mind Roger Corman, who may or may not have intended to be campy, but by the time they showed up on the screens, that's, you know, sort of what they became. And they were a staple of drive-ins, right? Roger Corman films.
Absolutely.
Man, any kind of horror, sci-fi, I mean, one of the things that's interesting just to think about the difference between seeing a movie in a theater and seeing it in a car is that it is necessarily more informal to see a movie in a car. It's just not as conducive to watching something serious as it is to watching something that's like big spectacle or comedy. I mean, you're just more distracted. You're more likely to talk, you know, all of the things that, you know, the theater has this sense of seriousness, you know, that you're sitting in your seat and this movie starts and that just kind of goes out the window. So it's great for films like the film Roger Corman was making in this time period.
Well, it's a much more interactive kind of experience. I mean, people feel more free to react to what they're seeing on the screen because they're essentially isolated in their own cars.
Which brings us to some of the kitschier films, one that Bill Smith especially liked.
This is Bill Smith and I'm calling from Chapel Hill, and the drive-in movie that came to mind when I heard Frank talk about this program today was one called The Loved One, about sort of the shysters in the funeral business. And it was this crazy movie with just the weirdest characters in it. Liberace played a coffin salesman, and Rod Steiger was the mortician, and with just a sort of a creepy fascination with corpses. And he lived with his mother, who was very gluttonous and would shoved so much food in her mouth that she couldn't hold it on. It was always down the front of her, and she would watch television and sort of screech and at the food commercials.
7:38, time for Big Boy Crab.
It's a new one.
It's a new one.
Oh, they're using a giant one. Oh, they're using a giant one now. Oh, God.
It does look good, doesn't it?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Oh, Mommy's little joy boy has piggy, piggy. Mommy's little joy boy has piggy for mom. Whoop,
ooh. So this was not a movie that people in Eastern North Carolina expected to see in 1965. It had something that could offend absolutely everybody.
Bill Smith, who didn't tell us if he took any of his recipes late of Crook's Corner from that film, but he certainly loved The Loved Ones, which now this was a surprise to me. Laura, what do you know about this film?
Well, this is a movie. It was directed by Tony Richardson right after he won the Oscar for Tom Jones. So he could make any movie that he wanted to. And he decided on the satire of the American funeral business that was written by Evelyn Waugh. And it is truly, you know, an astonishing cast that goes all the way from John Gielgud to Jonathan Winters. And it was meant to be offensive. And I remember seeing it years ago and thinking that it was funny. I have a feeling that the things that were offensive when the film came out in the 60s are probably different to the things that we would find offensive in the film today.
Right. A wild film, I have to say. Very, very on the wacky side. And I am trying to imagine, you know, Bill and his family in Eastern North Carolina in 65 trying to get through this
one. Who booked that film? I think that was a booking mistake.
Well, there's a scene where Liberace, in the role of the funeral home salesman, is upselling these people on a casket and a burial suit and shoes and memorial flames. And it is hilarious. I mean, Liberace is perfect in this role. It's an easy to find clip on YouTube.
It is. And also classics, Marcia. You picked one of your films, The Princess Bride. Why don't we do the clip and we'll talk about it in a minute.
Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I'm not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
You've made your decision then?
Not remotely. Because Iocane comes from Australia, as everyone knows. And Australia is entirely peopled with criminals. And criminals are used to having people not trust them, as you are not trusted by me, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you.
Truly, you have a dizzying intellect.
Wait till I get going. Where was I?
Australia.
Yes, Australia. And you must have suspected I would have known the powder's origin, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
You're just stalling now.
You'd like to think that, wouldn't you?
That is the classic clip from the 1987 clip, although there may not be a classic. 1987, Princess Bride, Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys here, Marcia's pick today.
Yeah, so, okay, little context. It's 1987 when this film comes out, so I am 16. And I know I drove my best friend, Lori Palmer, now Spivak, to the drive-in. She is 1 year older than me, sorry, Lori. And so she used to drive us to the drive-in, and now I could drive, right? Big deal. And so this movie, we used to go to the Winnetka drive-in. This is in the San Fernando Valley in Southern California. This is a huge drive-in. We're talking 6 screens, 2,300 car capacity, massive, massive drive-in. You could go every night of the week and see something different. And this movie stands out for me by far because, you know, we didn't know what to expect when we went to see it. This film was not like a massive success when it was released. It's kind of grown into cult status. And I just remember we thought it was the funniest thing we had ever seen in our lives, just like laughing harder than we'd ever laughed. And it's such like a joyous memory of like being a teenager, being with my best friend at this movie theater that we, you know, feeling independent and seeing something that is, you know, just a delightful film. And so it's I feel very nostalgic about that movie and having seen it there.
Yeah, well, talk more about that, Laura, because we've talked about the family aspect of this, but this was a big teen hangout, right?
Right. And because of people like Marcia who saw this movie and had such wonderful, warm feelings, that's why, you know, in repertory, showing The Princess Bride is a 100% sure thing. You can sell out any cinema showing The Princess Bride because for some reason it just hit a particular moment in the zeitgeist of people of a certain age who just really adore this movie.
That film, but yeah, go ahead, Marcia.
The humor is just, it's just so spot on. In the beginning, Peter Falk is, you know, introducing the story, and he says, you know, when I was your age, television was called books, you know, like so many great lines and ideas. It's the quality of the film, and the humor is gentle and fun. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a wonderful film.
Well, as we said, the drive-in was certainly a place where teenagers hung out. Marcia, as you said, exercising their freedom, newfound freedom, now that they could both drive and be alone. Why wouldn't the drive-in be the place to go? And here's one listener who has a drive-in memory as a teenager.
My name is Heidi Wilson, and I live in Cary, North Carolina. And when I was growing up, I grew up in a small town in central Pennsylvania. We had one local cinema, and then we had the drive-in movie. And the drive-in that I saw, that we saw, that I remember the absolute most was watching the first Star Wars movie in the summer of 1978, which was a year after the movie came out. And I drove there with my cousin and two of my best friends in my dad's VW Bug, and we watched, none of us had ever seen the first Star Wars movie, and we watched it and were absolutely blown away by the technology in that movie.
We're passing through the magnetic field.
Hold tight.
Put your deflectors on double front.
So the scenes that most amazed us were the fight scenes, sort of in outer space, and watching them, those space scenes from a drive-in seemed particularly perfect and different from anything that we'd ever seen before.
Heidi Wilson talking about seeing Star Wars Episode 4. Of course, that was the one that came out first in 1977. And I'm talking to Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. That really was a kind of a remarkable film in the sense that it took us back to the golden age of cinema when space adventures were the staple and yet brought lots of new technologies to the screen. Eh, Laura?
Well, and watching a movie set in outer space under the stars is a really kind of sort of magical communion, which I think is why a lot of science fiction movies really were staples at the drive-in.
Laura, you chose a film that Men in Black 3, which, you know, you might wonder about that choice, but it turns out you you saw it in Italy. So why don't we first listen to the film, a little clip, and then talk about it.
You need to turn electricity down on that damn thing. Can't taste my frickin' tongue, Kay.
How do you know my name?
What? Because I called you Kay? No, I call everybody Kay. It's kind of my thing. What up, Kay? All right, I sort of, Kay. Passa. Yeah, it's kind of my thing. I just, some people like it. Most people.
Now I know what you look like when you're lying. Why don't you show me what you look like when you're telling the truth?
I won those at Coney Island on the ring toss.
I won a stuffed bear once, but never one of these. Must be good, Slick.
All right, sir. I was minding my own business. I was out there waiting for my girl, who, by the way, is probably worried sick, looking for me right now. So I need my things and I need to get back to her.
What's your gal's name?
Huh?
Your gal, what's her name?
Darren?
Staring.
Agent K, played by Josh Brolin. Agent J, played by Will Smith, a scene from Men in Black 3, which Laura Boies saw outdoors in Italy? Really?
Yeah, so when I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, and I never went to a drive-in as a kid. There were no drive-ins, or my parents didn't take us to them. When I travel, I always try to have unique movie-going experiences if I can, and we were on vacation in a small town on the Amalfi Coast called Minori, and they had an outdoor cinema series. So we bought tickets, and we went and sat with everyone in the village. It was an intensely Cinema Paradiso kind of experience, and it was Men in Black 3 dubbed into Italian. And I don't speak Italian. I can say hello and goodbye and that kind of thing. But what I learned from this experience was that these blockbuster movies do not need language, because it was completely understandable in Italian, even though I don't speak the language, so much so that we even adopted a catchphrase from the movie, because there's a character who's horrible, and they call him Boris Animale, Boris the Animal, and he says, "Solo Boris, just call me Boris." So for the rest of the vacation, you know, we're Solo Boris, because that was the Italian that we learned. But they had, it was 35 millimeter print on two big reels. When they switched the reels, everybody ran to the concession stand.
I'm going to take a break right now and find out what they had at the concession stand at the Amalfi Coast. That's something I want to hear. Laura Boyes, curator of the North Carolina Museum of Art and Movie Diva Series, Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Movies on the Radio, Drive-In Memories, just ahead. Stay tuned. This is State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Social distancing guidelines encourage us to keep social interactions and activities outdoors. So today we're talking about movies that do just that. Drive-ins and outdoor screenings have shown classics like Star Wars and movies that parents watch while hoping the kids fall asleep in the back, like Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. For this month's Movies on the Radio, I'm talking about drive-in memories with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes. And let's hear from a listener for whom the drive-in actually enhanced the experience.
Hi, this is Jay Curtis. I'm calling from Cary, North Carolina. Back in the 80s in Lincoln, Nebraska, a group of friends and I went to the 84th and O drive-in to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And we did it in a 1969 red convertible Cutlass Oldsmobile car that was just amazing. Best part about it was, you know, in Close Encounters, right at the end where the mothership shows up at Devil's Tower, it shows up in a billowing cloud of lightning and thunder. And right at that moment in June in Nebraska, a lightning strike lit up a billowing cloud on the horizon. We felt like we had just become part of the movie.
Jay Curtis talking about the 1977 film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The environment does play a part in this, doesn't it, Laura? I mean, also the fact that you really have to wait until the world gets dark. You can't just turn out the lights, so you're really part of the environment. I mean, that does play a role.
Right, and it's interesting to me how many of these films are rather long, too, to really prolong your experience of being at the movies. The maximum enjoyment, maximum concessions sales as well, I'm sure.
So let's get back to Italy. What was the concession stand when
I think it was just popcorn and candy bars.
Yeah. Asiago cheese on the popcorn, maybe?
I don't think so. I think it was pretty basic. sorry, I got carried away there.
No, that's all right. I did not go to many drive-ins, but the few times I went, I did think that the actual cinematic experience, like, it looked a little washed out. I mean, it wasn't as powerful a movie experience.
Let me say a couple of things, because I have been thinking about the mechanics of going to a drive-in. People who have never gone, I mean, these things would mean nothing to them. But first off, the screen is like huge, right? So you have to be able to see it from cars spread all over, you know, pretty large acreage for the most part. So especially for something like Close Encounters, Star Wars, I mean, that would be particularly impressive to see that on a big screen. But, you know, you said the thing about waiting for dark. It reminded me of, like, struggling to find sometimes the antenna hookup that worked, because not all that you used to have to clip your antenna physically to the device. And sometimes you would drive off and forget to unclip it and pull it with you. I'm sure that was terribly annoying. And when people would, like, pull in late and they hadn't dimmed their lights, and then their lights would go on the screen and everyone would boo. And, like, I don't, there are all these mechanics of getting in and out that are just so specific to that ritual of seeing a movie at a drive-in.
Well, you talked about the importance of and popularity of sci-fi films on those big screens. Let's hear another listener.
Hi, this is Laura Skinner, and I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. My drive-in movie memory is about Planet of the Apes. When I was 11 years old, that movie came out, and my dad was a big science fiction fan and reader of science fiction, and he instilled that love in me as well. And so I was 11, my brother was 8 and had another brother who was 5. And the family went in my dad's car, which was a 66 Mustang 2+2 fastback gold with a black interior. And the back seat folded down completely flat. So all three of us kids would take sleeping bags and pillows, and my mom would pack snacks for us. And we'd pile up in the back of that Mustang and watch the movie. And I managed to stay awake and see it all the way to the end. I know a lot of times we fell asleep before the movie was over, but I do remember that movie and remember seeing the Statue of Liberty at the end of the movie and just thinking, wow.
Oh, my God. I'm back. I'm home. All the time. We finally really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you! Damn you all to hell!
It's never left me, and I've just been a fan of drive-ins ever since.
Laura Skinner saw Planet of the Apes at the drive-in, a film adapted from the French novel and directed by Franklin Schaffner. Let's talk about that film for a second, Marcia, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, well, what you can't see in hearing that is this shirtless Charlton Heston, you know, encountering that statue, half Statue of Liberty buried on the beach, and the camera pulls back and there it is. And I can only imagine how cool that would have been to see on a drive-in screen. But I want to mention something related, which is that Laura mentioned a very specific car again. How many people in their memories, it's tied to a specific make, model, memories of the car. I didn't say mine. Mine was a 1980 diesel Volkswagen Rabbit. Not as glamorous.
Well, that's a little down on the cool scale from that fastback Mustang.
It's true, but the mileage was excellent. Anyhow, but it's really tied to that experience of car culture. I mean, that is what this is all about, is people in their automobiles. Americans love cars. People have nostalgic memories of the old cars that they used to have or that their family has, and that's part of the movie-going experience. It's not anything like going to a theater.
What about Charlton Heston's imitation of Jon Stewart? I thought that was brilliant, didn't you? Damn you. Remember when he used to do that in every episode of The Daily Show? Apparently not. You can remember being 16 and seeing The Princess Bride, but not Jon Stewart almost daily saying, damn you.
I think I do have a vague recollection, but not as strong as
it was. A good show. It's kind of a news satire show. It's still on.
I've heard of it.
That is a big part of it. I think we've touched on it a little bit, but also about teenagers, and especially when they got minted, right? They got named, I think, somewhere in the 50s, they became a brand. And so the whole idea of having a car, having your freedom, and then having a place to go. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the mechanics, too, because you mentioned the speaker, but, you know, for people who haven't been there, Laura, talk about kind of how that whole trick worked.
I actually do not know.
Yeah, but I mean, what you have to do.
Right, Marcia?
Yeah, but you...
I do.
Go ahead, explain it, because you had to put this big clunky speaker in your window.
Well, actually, I'm a second-generation drive-in goer. That may have been the case in the earliest iterations, but by the time I went, there were these posts that were car widths apart from each other. You shared a post with the person next to you, and they had a little antenna. And they had a dangling cord with a clip, and you clipped that to your antenna. And then only when you turned your, you know, car to the setting where you could have electricity going to it, but it wasn't, you know, the car wasn't on, could you determine if you had a functioning one or not, or if some jerk, like I did many times, drove off and with the antenna on. There was a whole, and then I think at some point then they did it more like a broadcast, like on an AM station or something. So
I think that's what you do now, is you turn your radio to a frequency.
To a station. Had to find the right place.
Back in the Ozzy and Harriet days when I was seeing them, you actually took a speaker off a pole and opened your window and kind of either clipped it on or left your window open, and it was this giant speaker in your car.
Were there drive-ins around Buffalo, Frank?
There was. And the thing about Buffalo is in the summer, it doesn't get dark until dark enough until like 10 o'clock at night in the middle of the summer, because like 9:30, it's still dusk, you know. Mm-hmm. So
I remember waiting for those movies to start. You're like, come on, just get dark. Here's another drive-in related decision tree I remember, which is, you know, my drive-in theater was massive and had so many people there. It's like, were you going to stay for the credits? Were you going to stay for the end of the film? Because sometimes it could take 15 minutes to get out of there because every car had to like pull out and go in a queue and there was only one lane of exit. So you could be, as a teenager, very impatient and like, I don't know, maybe we should leave. It's 5 minutes before the end. That way we won't get stuck in traffic. There was always an exodus towards the end.
Yeah, a lot of cars leaving before the film was over. Marcia, you also have another choice here. Talk about snakes on a plane, which I guess, we still have
driving. I double dipped because, and the reason I wanted to was that this was a movie that I saw at the Starlight Theater in Durham, which closed the year after I saw it. This was a very unusual place. They sold ammunition at the snack bar. it's true. I did not purchase any, but Snakes on a Plane, well, the title tells it all, except maybe if you added the word poisonous to the title, it would be a little more explicit. But the point is, this was a perfect movie for a drive-in. I got a group of friends together. We went out there. We saw it. It's Samuel Jackson. It's Poisonous Snakes on a Plane.
It is this film.
Is there anyone here who knows how to fly a plane?
Claire. I'll do it. I'm sure the tower can talk me through it.
No, Flynn. I know Galanis' plane.
Who?
Him. Yeah, you. Come on, Troy. You know you can do this, man. Come on, take us home, dog.
You know how to fly?
Man, I got over 2,000 hours. This is all you talked about. Troy, you can do this.
Yeah, I can do this.
We gotta clear the snakes out of the cockpit.
Yeah, clear the snakes out of the cockpit,
Enough is enough! I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane! Everybody strap in! I'm about to open some windows.
Snakes on a Plane, directed by David R. Ellis, starring Samuel L. Jackson, Movies on the Radio. That's got it all, right? You're trapped in a small space with imminent danger, a lethal threat, and the pilot's dead.
It is a perfect drive-in movie because it didn't take itself too seriously. The whole point was to have fun when you went and saw this film. And so to see it at a drive-in, which to me is associated with that kind of like, you know, more frivolous entertainment and having such a good time with friends, having that experience, you know, as late as 2006. And I wish that theater could come back. It's really hard to do new drive-ins, I suspect, because you need so much space, and it has to be away from light and all the things. But I really treasure that memory.
Well, I guess that brings us to whatever happened to drive-ins. I mean, people still have cars, and it's still a cheap way to go see things. Laura, what caused the decline? Do you think?
I don't really know. I think it people willing to make the financial investment to keep the theaters open. Mm-hmm. Why did the one that Marcia went to, I mean, they had a lot of ancillary businesses.
The Starlight.
They had the gun shop, they had the flea market, they had all of these things that went on there.
Well, they had a fire like the year before, and I think the fire might have damaged the screen, and there was a big community fundraising thing to rebuild it, but then the owner died. And I don't know what happened to the property.
Well, let's hear one more before we close out and talk about where we are today.
This is Jenny Baird from Apex, North Carolina. For my daughter's 11th birthday, we took her to the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater to see Twilight movie Eclipse. And she and her friends sat right up front in their outdoor chairs and ate popcorn. And the girls especially enjoyed scenes where Jacob first comes to the screen and all the girls cheered. Some of them were Team Edward, some of them were Team Jacob.
Charlie said you left town.
Yeah, to visit my mom. Why?
Just checking to see if you're still human.
Look, I'm here to warn you. If your kind come on our land again,
you should leave. Now.
She has a right to know. She is the one the redhead wants.
Victoria? Alice's vision.
I was trying to protect you.
By lying to me.
The theater also gave her a tour of the projection room, and she was able to see how all of that worked. And they were very lovely and treated us extremely well.
Jenny Baird, who visited the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater with her daughter to see the third installment of the Twilight series, the Twilight Saga Eclipse, talking about drive-in movies with Laura Boyce and Marsha Gordon. Laura, I mean, are they making a comeback? I mean, that's the premise of this, that, you know, in some ways the conditions are right. Do we see any evidence of that?
Well, the one that I've been reading about is in Queens, New York. There is a diner that happened to be next to a gigantic parking lot. And when they were trying to figure out how to survive financially, they thought that they could repurpose the diner for takeaway food and use the parking lot next door as a drive-in movie theater. And apparently this has been quite popular. Of course, what they don't say is how many New Yorkers do not own cars, which makes going to the drive-in kind of problematic.
It's a New Yorker cartoon somehow with all these people standing at the post watching a drive-in in Manhattan.
They're like walking through the drive-in
teller.
Well, and so many of the films of the past two decades, I mean, certainly like the superhero films, they're kind of ready-made for that drive-in experience. Spectacular, and you know, even more serious versions of them, like Mad Max Fury Road. I would love to see that in a drive-in setting. And so, I mean, I think right now everything is up in the air. But I don't see all of a sudden there being drive-ins popping up all over the country and there being any kind of real resurgence, but I would be very happy to be wrong about that because I love going to them.
Well, at the beginning of the show, we opened up the possibilities, the two divergent possibilities. One, everybody's gotten so used to streaming that they'll never see a movie again. Two, everybody's gotten so sick of streaming, they can't wait to get out. Marsha, let me ask you, which way do you think it might go?
Well, I don't know that is the biggest motivator, I think, in terms of getting people back into the theaters. It's kind of interesting. Alamo Drafthouse, which there's a Raleigh location, did a survey fairly early on in this where it asked the people who go regularly to the theater to do, you know, to answer questions about what would make you comfortable, distance, et cetera. I think the bigger question is, are people going to feel safe?
Right.
And if they can feel safe, then I think that will bring them back.
Laura, I know the Carolina Theater has some plans, right? Tell us about those.
Yes, well, whenever the city of Durham reopens, they are hoping to reopen Fletcher Theater for at least, you know, 200 or 300 people at a time to come in and watch perhaps even, you know, first-run movies. So time will tell. I think the theater experience is really important, and I think the people who loved going to the theater a few months ago are going to want to return and have the theater experience.
That's right.
Laura Boyce is the curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series. Marsha Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you both.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
You can check out these films at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wodarski helped engineer the show today as well. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.